Hello, everyone. This is Patricia Corey. I'm your host for Beyond the Matrix, the radio program that asks you to, that dares you to think outside the box of convention and get yourself into the free thought zone as long as you can. Let your mind flow out in the cosmos of possibilities. And we're going to have a guest today with us that will help us do that a la grande, as the Italians say. His name is Christopher Dunn. You've heard of him for sure. His book came out in 1998. It was called, still is for that matter, The Giza Power Plant. And it is an amazing work of alternative ways of looking at the conventional concept of how and why the pyramid was built. And it's just a miracle that he's on my show. So I know we're going to have a wild hour talking with him, even though he's a technical... Let's talk about his background. Christopher Dunn is a craftsman. He's he's been a machinist, a toolmaker, programmer, works with high-powered industrial lasers, an engineer alla grande. And he's going to talk to us about his take on what the pyramid and other structures in Egypt are all about. How does that sound, Christopher? Have I described you well?
Well, I'm blushing. Thank you very much for that wonderful introduction.
I was going to also say you're a genius, but I think that it goes without saying.
No, I don't think I'm a genius by any means.
I think you are.
I know some geniuses, and I'm not one of them.
Well, you're as close as I think that I'm going to get in this lifetime, so... Thank you for being here. Okay, I won't stroke your ego. I know that that's not what we're doing here on the show. But really, really respect your work, and I'm very excited that you've agreed to come. Knowing what a busy man you are and knowing that you do a lot of TV as well, I'm sure my audience is just thrilled that you're giving up your time.
Well, certainly. It's an honor to be invited on your show, and I'm very, very pleased to be here. And as far as genius, I look at Einstein and some of the physicists that are working in the new field of nanotechnology, and I certainly do not compare myself to that kind of genius. And in fact, that would probably be a good starting point, Patricia, to talk about when we're looking at problems. And And when I looked at the problem of the huge question mark of the Great Pyramid, it was really a very simple concept, and in terms of what it was for. But then the evidence to gather together to support the original theory took many, many years, but it was basically more detective work than sheer genius. And a lot of synchronicity along the way, people coming in and out of my life with different bits of information. So the Giza Power Plant is certainly, it has my name as the author, but it wouldn't exist without a lot of other wonderful people helping.
Well, thanks to you and all of them, because it really is a significant work, I think, for our generation. I really do feel strongly about it. We'll get into the book in a minute. But I'd like to start, first of all, by celebrating the fact that you dare to come out so boldly against the conventional wisdom of the Egyptologists like Zahi Hawass. And it must have been a little bit tricky to get support on that end.
Actually, it's not tricky at all, Patricia. When you look at who you think may be supportive of your work and who may not, you can certainly separate out most Egyptologists, particularly Zahi Hawass, and so I don't even bother looking for support in areas where I know I'm going to get it, and those are areas that I know I'm not going to get it. So it's not bothersome to me. It's not my intention to persuade the Egyptological community, but to actually provide some new ideas or a different way of looking at things for people like me, which are just lay people or people who have some experience in technology, or maybe engineers or technical people, or even people without any background in engineering can,
like me,
they can actually work through the book and understand it and see at least, if they don't agree with the conclusions, they can at least see the threads of evidence and to why I actually reached those conclusions.
Indeed, so, but when I talk about support, I'm also meaning being able to get out there and get into, let's say, harder to access places on the plateau. Don't you find that it's important to have somebody opening doors for you, or did you work around that?
That's a very good question. It is, you know, it is
a situation.
It may seem to be difficult or tricky, as you say, and that's probably a good word. But it's actually the way I approach it is very I would say it is pretty laissez-faire. When I go to Egypt, I take some instruments and I would like to accomplish certain research. I find that some doors are closed to me, and even though I may have prior arrangement to do something, it's not possible.
Yeah.
For instance, I'll give you an example. I tried very, 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 very hard to get into the Serapeum near Saqqara. And I found myself in there in 1995 when I was on location with Netherlands Television, with Graham Hancock and Robert Pavel, and we were doing a documentary. And so they had permission to go in, and I was going along with them. And what I found there was unbelievable to me, a manufacturer and somebody who's worked with precision machine tools for many, many years, finding these startling evidence of advanced machining or advanced technology in the production of huge granite boxes. And these granite boxes are actually, if people go to my website, they can go on GizaPower.com and they can look at the photographs in a article there. The article is entitled "The Precision of the Ancient Egyptians." Or they can go on the main page and link to the artifacts on the Giza Plateau and other places. There is a lot of photographs on that top link. But the manufacturing abilities of the ancient Egyptians has been a consuming interest for me, and it has been through, I would say, synchronicity, being in the right place with the right person at the right time. And for instance, the photographs that you'll see of me inside this granite box with a precision toolmaker's square and straight edge, and actually doing a comparative check on the flatness and squareness on the inside of the box, that was actually with permission of Zahi Hawass. And it was taken in 2001, and I was on location with Grizzly Adams Productions doing a documentary with them. And the producer, Gail Fallon, was a very petite, very nice-looking, blonde woman. And Zahi Hawass, I don't know if you've ever met him or know him very well, but he always seems to get along very, very well with American women.
Yeah.
And why not? I mean,
As long as they don't talk about Atlantis.
We don't talk about Atlantis. I mean, certainly you have to respect his point of view.
Yes,
it's the kind of thing that I don't talk about anything with him that I know that would be objectionable to him. And
yeah.
So, for the most part, I don't talk about the Giza power plant with him. But I've met him a few times, and And he's been alternately very, very aggressive and passionate and dismissive, and other times he's been very charming. This time, in the company of Gail Fallon, he was very, very charming and gave us written permission to go in many different places on the Giza Plateau and then the Serapeum. So,
well, I'll have to remember that, because I'm not petite and I'm not blonde, but I am an American woman, so I'll keep that confidence in mind.
I don't think you have to be blonde for Zahi.
Okay. I'm not petite either, but we'll do our best. All right, let me ask you then, what did you, you talked about the granite box, but can you give us more information about what you found that was so amazing about this discovery there?
Well, these boxes are cut out of solid piece of granite, and the surfaces on the inside that I was checking, had the same precision that you would find on a modern manufactured surface plate. They were very, very precise. The gauge that I used had a precision of 1/20th the thickness of a human hair.
Wow.
Yes, so that is very, very precise.
That's precise, I'd say.
And sliding it along the surface of the granite surface on these boxes, I found that there was no variation in the surface of the granite. It was very, very precise. Shining a light, seeing if there was any gaps or a very, very small gap between the surface of the gauge and the granite would even a thousandth of an inch would show, and I didn't notice any variation there. So the other amazing thing is it's not just the flatness, but the squareness, and so it's the manufacturing capability, because the photographs that you see, I'm showing the square on one surface of the box, the underside of the lid, and then directly opposite on the other inside wall, we have the same condition. Well, that indicates that those two surfaces, those two walls on the inside of the box, were crafted perfectly parallel with each other, because otherwise that condition would not exist. That is an unbelievable feat, and I went to several granite manufacturers who their work was actually in precision granite manufacturing. They ground these artifacts to a very high order of precision. And only one actually responded, and they came back and said that they could not produce this box. They don't have the equipment to do it. And if they...
Now, if I can interrupt you a moment, one of the things I find very exciting about your work is that you constantly refer to the fact that not even modern technology can, in many cases, reproduce what the Egyptians were doing God knows how many thousands of years ago.
Well, yes. I think that I would not say emphatically that we couldn't do it, because it's just like the Hubble Space Telescope. It did take an extraordinary effort. It was conceived of and it was accomplished. And the new different tools and tools were designed and built just to accomplish the Hubble Space Telescope. So, if we had a purpose or a reason to do this, we could probably design the tools and the means and methods to actually produce it. But the investment would be enormous. Just the raw block of stone would cost over $250,000. And to machine it out and finish it out on the inside to this order of precision would cost an unbelievable amount of money. I mean, I couldn't even fathom right now how much it would cost to do that.
And plus, we have not only this granite box you're talking about, but so many of the coffins, let's call them, or the sarcophagi, are also granite carved.
Right. Yeah. And even in the tunnels at the Serapeum where this box is located, there's over 20 of them. So it's not just one box. I mean, they were accomplishing this kind of work in in many different boxes, and in the King's Chamber and the Great Pyramid, and particularly Khafre's Pyramid, there is a granite box in the so-called King's Chamber that has an equal precision to what you see here. So it's they were masters at working with this granite.
So and how do you feel that they accomplished this? What does your intuition or your research tell you?
Well, my intuition, now my actually based on my experience in manufacturing and looking at the features, and there are certain features on these boxes that indicate the means of manufacture. One of the more telling ones is at the corner radius, where the surfaces come together in the corner. It's very, very sharp, extraordinarily sharp for something this large. And you have to ask the question, why do they have to have it that sharp? Well, the means to accomplish this in terms of finishing it, I believe that they had to have had some kind of a guided tool that was very, very precise, and it actually cut the surfaces on the inside the same way that we would have a machine tool that is guided along a granite base, because we actually use granite today for some machine tools and particularly inspection equipment like coordinate measuring machines, because it's very stable material and it does not shrink or warp, or there's no variation in the surface once you get it finished to a perfect flatness.
But okay, let me interrupt you and ask you this then. What about the possibility, and of course I'm no scientist or engineer, so don't laugh at my question. What is the possibility that they could have been using some form of laser to do this cutting?
The laser is not really an efficient tool for cutting stone, because the laser is a thermal process. And in fact, I started in the laser manufacturing in 1983, and we were working with high-powered YAG lasers and CO2 lasers, and we were cutting aircraft-type materials, exotic metals. But the cutting stone, or cutting granite particularly, if you consider granite is actually an igneous rock, and so it is a thermal, it would withstand a lot of heat, and as the laser is a thermal process, then it's not a very good tool to do that.
So what do you think they were using?
I think they were using special grinding equipment, and essentially what they would use would be a diamond, probably a rotating disc that was grinding the surface and actually moving along an axis and finishing it with precision. There is evidence too in other areas, not just on these granite boxes, but also on the Giza Plateau. We find out in the open evidence that shows that objects would have used a multi-axis machine to create the contours on these granite ashlars, these beautiful granite on the side, on the south side of the Valley Temple. And I don't, you've been to the Valley Temple, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But on the south side, on the outside of the Valley Temple, is a granite ashlar, which just lying there. Originally was on the top of the wall, but this is an object that has a three-dimensional profile. It's a the profile consists of two radii that are tangent with each other. They flow together, they are extremely precise, and the geometry is very, very precise. So how do they create that? You know, well, Egyptologists will tell you that they use dolerite pounders and pounded on the rock with another rock.
I just saw one of these Discovery Channel well-done productions where we're shown how they create these points of impact on the stone, and then they pound, and then it cracks in half. And that would certainly not explain one-tenth the thickness of a hair precision.
No, and they never do. But because they can take one stone and beat another stone and remove some material, they think they've solved the problem. And they haven't solved the problem because they haven't really explained anything. A child can do that.
Let me ask you this. Why would it be so hard for the conventional thinkers to embrace the idea that a higher form of technology was known to the Egyptians at a certain point in the evolution of this civilization? They should be proud of this now.
Oh, I think that's a very, very good question. And I'm I wonder, too, and I particularly wonder why the Egyptians don't embrace the idea that their ancestors were highly advanced. And it's amazing to me that they don't look at this. And are they still actually accept the Western Greco-Roman model or historical model, which puts the Egyptians further down on the evolutionary train, where you know they have a linear view of history, and the Egyptians were not as advanced as the Greeks or the Romans. But the evidence on the ground in Egypt is something entirely different, in my opinion.
I think it also might have to do with the fact that Zahi Hawass and his school of thought just don't want to embrace the idea that there could have been an influence from Atlantis or any other highly evolved civilization that would have come in and given a jump start to the civilization.
Yes,
and so for this reason, it's like he wants to go down, you know, to the primitive, really primitive beginnings.
Well, I think,
really.
Yeah, and in one sense, I think that's where the mistake has been made. And basically, what a lot of people have said is that, well, the Egyptians of 4,500 years ago, 5,000 years ago, were not capable of this kind of work. I mean, it's obvious if you look in the ancient Egyptians' toolbox, you don't find the tools that are capable of doing this work. And so they immediately jump to a different culture coming in and helping them out. Whereas there could be another answer to that question.
Right.
And that is,
it could also be that the tools have been removed so that they can hold on to that approach they have of the history of Egypt.
Yes, but removed or actually over time destroyed, carried off, for all those reasons. But not just the tools have been destroyed, but the knowledge of how they worked has been destroyed. Because I definitely believe in my heart that there was a cataclysm in the past that destroyed large segments of civilizations on the planet. And the survivors went through a lot of suffering, and they couldn't rebuild their society back to what it was. And so ultimately, after generation after generation, they forgot. They sank into a primitive or very simple agrarian type society. The same thing.
But if I can interject something here, let's not forget, if we look at our society, let's talk about from 100, maximum 150 years ago, we didn't even have electricity.
Right.
Okay.
Right. I mean,
so,
that's occasion.
So here we are, you know, we look at Egypt with its thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
And to make some sort of, let's say, reference point, we have to remember that what we've accomplished in 150 years in so-called contemporary society,
mm-hmm.
and look at how much potential time there was for the sophisticated societies to come and go in the history of Egypt, or the history line, the timelines of the many civilizations of Egypt.
Absolutely, and I think that's where the arrogance of the Western mind comes in, to think that they are the first and the only advanced civilization that existed on the planet. And I think there may be another reason for that. It may not just be chauvinism, or it could be real fear, because imagine the implications of actually knowing or understanding that civilizations are actually mortal and they can be destroyed, and nature is cyclical, and these events visit us every so often, and we are going to be faced with it. Our civilization is going to be faced with it eventually.
Yeah, well, hopefully later, not sooner, the way we're going here.
Well, hopefully later, yes. But, you know, the way the universe works, it seems that civilizations over the centuries have risen and fallen. And to think that we would escape that, I think it's a comforting thought to think we could escape it. And I would certainly contribute to any effort to escape it, because certainly I don't want to, you know, die in a ball of fire or in a tsunami. But when you look at what has happened in the past, I think we do have to take measure of our lives and say, okay, you know, how do I want to live my life? Because this this could be the last.
Yeah, that's plan. My motto. I really feel that it's important for people to understand that every day is to be worth to celebrate it. It could be your last. And to live it as filled as possible with light and love and celebration, instead of all this dread and doomsday living that we are being guided to through our government.
Yeah, you know, when I was in Egypt in 2007, I almost died and was taken to the hospital. And there's one thing that I learned through that experience was that at the end of your life, there's only two things that you can take with you, and that is love and the goodwill and the good thoughts of your friends and family. Other than that, you're not taking anything.
Yeah.
So, you know, you got to be kind.
Yeah, especially to yourself. Chris, let's get back now to my curiosity bell is going ding, 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 and I'd like to ask you, I see that you you know about the Coral Castle mystery, and I'd love to talk about what methods, apparently the man who built Coral Castle has now passed, right?
Yes.
Okay, so just for the listeners that maybe not know about Coral Castle, a gentleman recreated a megalithic structure in a place called Coral Castle, Florida, recently, and he used to work at night. People would hear strange sounds and all kinds of things going on, but he never revealed how he did this, correct?
That's correct.
Unfortunately, he passed away, and he seems to have discovered the mystery, possibly, of lifting megalithic stones, as the Egyptians did. And I have my own opinion how they did this, which I think involves sound. But I'd love to have your information of how you believe he reproduced, or at least let's say how he produced this phenomenon of creating a megalithic modern site on his own.
Well, I think that Edley Skalman definitely knew the secrets of how the pyramids were built. He said that. He said, I know the secrets of how the pyramids were built. And he's the only person that I have read about or heard about who actually has done something where you could look at it and say, you know, I think this fellow was onto something, because he's reputed to only weigh about less than 100 pounds. He was a very small fellow from Latvia. And over a course of about 28 years, 27 years, he built this castle in Homestead, Florida, out of monolithic coral blocks of stone. And the heaviest stone that he lifted was a 30-ton block, But there were other items that were very, very large. An obelisk that weighed 23 tons, and other extremely large objects. He had a 9-ton gate that was perfectly balanced. It's a really odd place to go. I've been there several times, and I definitely recommend people to visit it.
I'd really love to visit it.
Yes. It's fascinating. It's a fascinating place. Now, as far as how he did it. Sorry?
What do you think? How did he do it?
Well, you know, I think that he was, he used some form of combination of sound, vibration, and electromagnetism. That's my feeling. And he had some kind of machine where he was affecting the magnetism or the natural magnetism of the Earth and in some way reversing the polarity and reducing the pull, the gravitational pull on granite, on the coral blocks. Now, why do I say that? Because it's kind of crazy. Well, we're freewheeling and out of the box. This fellow was freewheeling and out of the box, and he had a different view of nature than the scientists. He wrote a couple of pamphlets, one on electricity, the other one on magnetism. But based on his understanding or what he believed about nature and electricity, he believed that that gravity, it was just a individual magnets that were being emitted from the Earth. Well, if you understand the nature of a magnet, you've got a north and a south pole. So you have one that's like attracts the unlike, so you'd be north and south would be attracted together. But he believed that these individual magnets moved through space, moved through materials, and actually created this effect that we know of as electricity and gravity. Well, if you get inside Lee Skalner's head and say, okay, well, if that is true, then was he in some way reversing the polarity on the individual magnets in the coral so that they were aligned in opposition to the individual magnets emitted from the Earth?
So in other words, it would become almost weightless.
It would become weightless and float.
That is amazing.
It's a speculation. And, you know, some of the photographs that you see of him at the coral castle show him working with very large tripods. And these tripods have a box on the top of them and wires running down from the top of the box, And he has several of these tripods around his place. And on the tripod is a chain hoist for lifting. And looking at the chain hoist, the chain that I measured was rated for about 10 tons. So he was incapable of actually lifting the 30 ton or the 23 tons that he had shown that he was able to lift. So it's a real enigma. It's a puzzle. And, a lot of people, you know, speculate about how he might have done it. And, you know, some people have actually tried to replicate, some of the equipment that he has. But to my knowledge, nobody yet has actually been able to duplicate his feat.
But why didn't he leave us this wisdom? Why did it have to disappear with him? This is really disturbs me.
Yeah, and I think that too. my feeling is on why he took the secret to the grave with him is because he was, a product of World War II Europe. He didn't trust government. He didn't trust people.
Yeah.
And so he just wouldn't share. He was afraid that his secret will get into the hands of the military and the government people.
Well, that would make sense. That would be a fear that would, would be probably warranted. Imagine anti-gravity. Well, I don't want to even imagine it.
Well, could you, I mean, could you imagine a world with that kind of technology, though, where, you know, we have got gases going over $4 a gallon, and then all of a sudden we have this technology, and then we don't need that much gas anymore, because we would be able to, you know, essentially, the reason why we burn so much gas or use so much energy is to overcome gravity. That's it in a nutshell. When we get in our vehicles and we drive down the road, we are propelling and pushing against the forces of gravity. So if you can overcome the gravity, then you don't need as much energy to move around.
Imagine then, he obviously was a very spiritual person, the responsibility of such knowledge.
He was tapped into something. I mean, he was a very odd fellow. As far as what was going on in his mind, I have no idea, but he wrote a little book called A Book for Every Home, which is a real oddity for those who have read it. Essentially, the book is an instruction manual on how to raise a young lady. And he is your quintessential male chauvinist in terms of how his opinions on how young ladies should be raised. It certainly wouldn't work in an American household, I can tell you. But it's an odd book. But, you know, by the same token, I think, you know, is this some kind of code? Is there something? Did he leave his secret? But we just got to figure it out yet.
So then let's segue right into your opinion of how the huge stones were lifted for the pyramid. You're not going to get away from this. I have to know.
You know, most people have opinions on how the stones were lifted in Egypt. I would have to rely on Mr. Lee Scanlon. Ed Lee Scanlon and Coral Castle. My bet would be on whatever technique he had developed, if we could replicate it, then I think we could say with confidence that we may be able to build the Great Pyramid and some of the other structures in Egypt, because the methods that are put before us in terms of moving monolithic pieces of stone that weigh 500 tons, 1,000 tons, and lifting, you know, all the granite beams above the King's Chamber, 175 feet in the air, they just don't seem to fit.
I would say that's an understatement. You know, we keep being shown these primitive reenactments of, you know, creating these what would you call them? These primitive wheel-like bases, the rock tumbles onto, they drag it with 100 men up the mountain, and it's really kind of ridiculous.
But yes, I think lately there have been quite a few documentaries created that purport to tell us how the ancient Egyptians built their pyramids and moved stones up to build their pyramids. And in those documentaries, you always see a bunch of guys in diapers pulling on a sled with like a half ton block on it, which is really funny. I think I normally turn those documentaries off anymore. I don't even like to watch them because they're just so unrealistic.
Yeah, they did one recently about the blue stones at Stonehenge. The same thing. These stones were dragged across I don't know how many kilometers of land with these funny little man-made rolling machines out of wood. You've got a 700-ton stone on a slatted wooden pulley. Please. It's time for some more information to come out.
I think there is a huge question mark on that, and people around the world really would like to know the answer to it, and they're not satisfied with what they're taught or what they see on these official documentaries, and you know the wealth of information that is available to point to and say, well, if you're going to create a documentary to show how the ancient Egyptians built the pyramids, take the most difficult aspects of the work that you know of and replicate that. And they never do, because you can do something that's simple and small, and that's what they tend to do. And then they say, okay, well, we've been able to move this 2-ton block with 5 people, so you know we could move 1,000 ton if we just add more people and do the ropes.
70,000 people later, we've got and one least, stone lifted.
Yeah,
all right, Chris, we've got to jump now to the big question.
Oh,
the pyramids
one.
Were not tombs, what were they?
Well, the title of my book is The Giza Power Plant, and it proposes that they were used to generate energy. Now, the title may be a little off-putting for some people, but we have to consider what this power was, what this energy was. And really, it's as it's described in The Giza Power Plant, it's energy, a natural energy that's drawn from the earth. And it's converted into microwave energy through a process in the King's Chamber, and it actually uses all the evidence that we find inside the Great Pyramid to support the theory. Now, the interesting thing about this particular aspect of it is that the book is 10 years old, as we noted earlier. And over the years, more insight and information has come to me. And so I'm very encouraged. But at the same time, I think that the true benefits from this kind of a power system are not necessarily just for producing energy. Because what I've come to believe and understand is that the greater function of the machine is to harmonize the planet. In other words, drive the plates into resonance, relieve stresses in the earth plate, which at the same time, being harmonious to human beings, relieves stresses in human beings too. So you could have a very holistic power system that energizes the population in more ways than one. It's just like, you know, there are sounds that we hear as we go through life, and some sounds are very grating on the nerves, others are very soothing and very pleasing. And as the Great Pyramid, the pyramids were actually acoustical devices, then they can generate vibrations in the earth and in people that would be beneficial to them.
Well, in fact, I've brought a lot of groups into the chamber, and we've done a lot of toning, and it's just so remarkable what happens. I mean, we do collectively even see beings appear there on the waves.
I think for me, Patricia, I've been in the Great Pyramid many times, and if you haven't actually been into the Great Pyramid and experienced it, it's very difficult to understand it. But there certainly is a profound effect on the human organism. And it can actually, you know, really stimulate creativity. There are many, many different, it can affect you on many different levels. And, you know, to actually enjoy a feeling of cosmic consciousness and oneness with your fellow man and the universe, there's no place like the Great Pyramid to achieve that.
That's so true. And I'm going to tell you a little story. You said that you got sick in Egypt, and so did I. Many years ago, I developed pneumonia when I was there. And I went into the Great Pyramid with my partner, my boyfriend, trying to suppress the coughing so that he could have an experience, because I had been there many times and he had never been there. And here I am, this nonstop coughing. To make a long story short, when I got back to Rome, I had to go immediately to the hospital. And when they took the x-ray, the doctor said, as you see here, in Italian, of course, there is a pyramidal form of pneumonia in your left lung. And he didn't know that I'd been in Egypt. I said, excuse me, how did you describe that? He said, there's a pyramidal structure in your lung. And I thought, oh, my God, I bet you the pyramid somehow contained that pneumonia from spreading.
Wow.
And that geometry was reproduced in the consciousness of the bacteria or virus that had created the pneumonia in my lung.
Yep. Yeah, well.
And when he showed me the x-ray, which I hope I still have, it was, in fact, a pyramid.
Really?
What do you think of that?
Well, I believe you. I really believe you. At one time in my life, I wouldn't have, but I've experienced enough and seen enough and felt enough in Egypt that I definitely believe you.
In fact, from my near deathbed, when I just looked at him, I had no strength left at all. But when he said there's this pyramidal structure in your lung, it definitely got my attention.
Yeah, I'd say.
So then, your book talks about the power plant aspect, and we're not going to be able to really elaborate it in the time we've got here, but can you give us a real synopsis of your thesis, your theory about how this worked?
Yes. The main features of the pyramid, of course, are the massive stone covering 13 acres. But the features on the inside are the subterranean chamber, a descending passage that goes down to the subterranean chamber, an ascending passage, grand gallery, and then the king's chamber, or so-called king's chamber, and the queen's chamber, which is below the king's chamber. The conventional theory is that the Khufu wanted this pyramid built, and they built the subterranean chamber, he changed his mind, then they built the so-called queen's chamber, he changed his mind again, and then they built, finally, the king's chamber. Well, my theory takes into effect all the the features within the pyramid, including the precision, because if you look at the cross-section of the Great Pyramid, the schematic looks more like a machine than it does any other kind of tomb or structure. And because of the passageways being so small, about 41 inches square, and then the chambers having shafts run off them on angles, and some of the anomalies that we find inside the king's chamber and above the king's chamber, that's what actually set me on my quest to try and understand further how this thing worked, because rationally I had determined, well, what if this thing is a power plant, because it is the largest structure on the planet, and it was for many, many years the largest structure on the planet, and why would somebody build something so huge just so that they could bury one body or one king? It just didn't make sense to me. And then, of course, the state of the art in the manufacturing of it, the building of it, everything's so precise, and one example is the descending passage over 150 feet being straight within 20 thousandths of an inch, or the thickness of a thumbnail. And
Say that again?
The descending passage, over 150 feet through this constructed portion, it was measured by Petrie in 1883, and he found that it was within 20 thousandths of an inch, the thickness of a thumbnail, of being absolutely straight.
That's remarkable.
It is remarkable, and throughout the inside of the pyramid, the blocks, the limestone blocks in the queen's chamber, are fitted so that even a piece of paper would not fit within it. I mean,
that's true.
It's beautiful, beautiful stonework, very, very finely finished. And so, essentially, taking all the features and all the evidence within the Great Pyramid, I renamed the features. The subterranean chamber is still the subterranean chamber, of course. The Queen's Chamber became the reaction chamber because of the salt substances that were found on the wall, and also these shafts leading down into, but not connecting to the chamber, which I proposed delivered chemicals, where the chemicals mixed and created hydrogen. And then the hydrogen flowed upwards into the King's Chamber, and the vibration in the pyramid, and collected by resonators in the Grand Gallery, which I renamed the Resonator Hall, which explains a lot of the slots along the length of the Grand Gallery. And that sound was focused into the King's Chamber, which is comprised purely of granite. And the King's Chamber, I call the resonant quartzite chamber, is actually independent from the rest of the structure. It's not tied into the core masonry, and it vibrates freely and resonates freely, and has actually been tested by acoustic engineers who have determined that it actually has a resonant frequencies, and they form an F-sharp chord. And so there's a lot of different clues, if you will, within the Great Pyramid to support the power plant theory. Some people would say, okay, well, perhaps they weren't using it for like a power plant that we would use today in terms of creating electricity to fuel our civilization and, you know, so operate our toasters and microwave ovens, but maybe it was a communication device or something of that nature.
So, or maybe they're harvesting the energies of the planet.
And they're harvesting the energy. They definitely, the core is that they were harvesting the energy of the planet. And they were driving the planet to resonance, to vibrate at a particular frequency. And actually,
that works for me in my own work and my own studies and books. That is exactly in tune with, no pun intended, with what I bring forward. So I'm really glad to hear you say that. What about the subterranean chamber? It is not finished. How do you describe that?
The subterranean chamber is an incredible, actually carefully designed chamber. You would think that it wasn't finished, but it was. It doesn't look like it's finished because it's rough and it doesn't have any particular design or recognizable design to it. In other words, it's not square, it's not round, it's got deep gouges in the floor, it's got these unusual baffles towards the east, or the west rather, but the chamber. And this is an interesting story that I'll tell you if I have time. There's a gentleman in Bellingham, Washington, who is actually, you could probably describe him as the guy, you know, Richard Dreyfuss in Close Encounters,
mm-hmm.
when he was building his mashed potato mountain in his living room. Well, this guy's name is John Cadman, and he was all consumed by the question of the subterranean chamber. And he was getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning. He'd wake up at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, and he'd be out in his living room carving a model of the subterranean chamber out of plaster. And he spent years actually doing research on this. And what he ended up with, and I went out to visit him because I didn't want to dismiss it out of hand without actually witnessing what he was talking about. And he said that I have a pulse generator. The subterranean chamber is a pulse generator. And of course he sent me all his drawings and his calculations and, and how it worked, and I thought, well, that's really, really nice, but I need to actually witness it and see it. So I flew out to Washington specifically to do that, And I did it while a hydraulics engineer, Dr. Jack Cole, was in the area, and he was there just to witness it too. Patricia, it was amazing. What he had done is he had actually reverse engineered the subterranean chamber. He had the descending passage down into the chamber, and down the descending passage, water flowed. Well, what he did was he turned a valve, water actually started to flow up a pipe. He choked off that valve and opened up another one, and it flowed down to a wastegate. And as soon as the wastegate, which was actually a little flapper valve, as soon as it started operating, the ground started to thump under my
feet.
Wow! And this thing was going thump 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 thump. It was beating like a heart.
Was he picking up the heartbeat of the planet?
You know, I can't help but make that connection that you could tune this to the heartbeat of the planet, and the thing was a very holistic power plant. They were feeding a heartbeat into the Earth's plate to gently release the stresses that build up in the Earth's crust, where the plates meet, and I mean, you're from California, you'd understand this.
Oh yeah.
That where the plates meet, and they build up those stresses. After a few years, it will release, and you'll have an earthquake.
Chris, so, believe it or not, we are just about running out of time here. So
Okay.
I can't bear to interrupt you because this is getting really where I want to be now. But I know there are a lot of things that I want to share with people on the work that you're up to now. So I'd like to remind listeners that Chris has just come out with an amazing article called The Mega Saws of the Pyramid Builders, which is a fascinating read. It's in Atlantis Rising magazine in the June edition. Get it. It's more mind-blowing material. And don't forget to visit his site at GizaPower.com. And I'm not supposed to mention it, but he does have a book coming out eventually soon. And so we haven't heard the end by any means.
There's lots of marvelous stuff coming. Lots of good new stuff.
Oh, I can't wait. Please let me know so I can get the first copies.
Okay, then.
Okay. We've been speaking tonight with Christopher Dunn, the author of The Giza Power Plant, and unfortunately our time is up, so all I can do is say, will you come back again, and we'll pick up where we left off.
It would be my pleasure.
Thank you, Christopher. Okay.
Thank you very much.
And thank you. And don't forget, I'm taking a group of people again this January to Egypt, and we'll take you down to the subterranean chamber, and you can listen to the heartbeat of the earth. So put that on your calendar, January 2009, and if you want more information about it, write to me. You can get all the contact information on my site, SyrianRevelations.net. Okay, everybody, that's all for now. Stay with me next week. We've got more exciting information for you. I'll have Jap Van Etten, who is an expert on crystal skulls, for another scintillating hour of life beyond the matrix. Thanks again, Christopher. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Good night and goodbye, everyone. Thank
Bye-bye.
You for listening.